This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
It's pretty common for folks to get confused about where you've come to visit today, so let's clear it up. The moment you cross the bridge, you enter the town of Jarden. Miracle is the national park that surrounds and protects that town from those who would corrupt its exceptional properties.
The exceptional properties this place possesses, and no one knows exactly what those qualities are, appear to have protected the town from what's known as the Great Departure, the sudden and inexplicable event in which 2% of the world's population instantaneously disappeared, leaving everyone left on Earth grieving. Was this an act of God? The Rapture? A supernatural event? No one knows for sure. But on the HBO series The Leftovers, everyone is becoming a little unhinged in their search for meaning and comfort. My guests are the two co-creators of the series. Tom Perata also wrote the novel it's based on, as well as the novels Election and Little Children. Damon Lindelof was the co-creator and showrunner of Lost. The Leftovers season 2 finale is this Sunday. In this season, several of the main characters have moved from a small town in New York to Miracle, Texas, in the hope of starting fresh in a safe place. Needless to say, things haven't worked out as they expected. In this scene, one of the characters, Matt Jameson, a minister who's one of the few people who has kept his faith, has been unable to get back into Miracle because his Miracle ID bracelet and his wife Mary's were stolen. Security is tight around the town, and you can't get in without that ID. They're stuck just outside the town, where a makeshift camping ground has sprung up of seekers, pilgrims, drifters, misfits, and con men drawn to Miracle. The minister needs money to hire a smuggler to get him and his wife Mary back into Miracle, so he approaches a woman who has a huge wooden cross standing in front of her ramshackle trailer. Next to her is a small statuette of Jesus. The woman is played by Brett Butler, the minister by Christopher Eccleston.
Sandy, I'm asking for your help. I'm calling upon your sense of community and charity. Mary and I need some money so that I can get
it. How much?
$500. I know that's an extraordinary amount of money, but I give you my word as a Christian, I will pay you back.
What denomination?
20s. Whatever you can...
No, you're a reverend. What denomination?
Episcopalian.
Why?
My father was a reverend. I was raised in the faith, but I welcome all beliefs into my church.
Where'd you go to seminary?
Berkeley Divinity.
Where's that?
Connecticut.
What's your favorite book of the Bible? You got a favorite book?
Job.
What's his wife's name?
She isn't named, and she speaks only once. Dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die.
Wait right here.
Good thing I didn't say Lutheran.
And we'll talk more about the Book of Job a little later. Damon Lindelof, Tom Perata, welcome to Fresh Air. I love the series. The first season, I think, was really about living in the presence of death and dealing with the pain of loss and not understanding why. Why do people leave us? Why do they die? Season one was based on your novel, Tom. And season two departs from the novel because you already told the story that was in the book and then some. So season two is set in Miracle. And the whole idea of, you know, of Miracle is it's this place where, like, no one was departed. So people assume if you're in this place, then you're safe. If this kind of event happens again, you will be safe. But you need approval, you need a special ID before you're allowed in. And this whole culture has developed outside the town. It's like a carnival of desperate people, religious zealots, self-appointed prophets, con men, smugglers, people who just gravitate to crazy. There's a whole tourism industry of people making a pilgrimage, people wanting water from the local quarry, which they assume must be like holy water. Can you talk about envisioning what this place would look and feel like and who'd be there?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing to say is that as we've worked on the show over the past two seasons, we've come to really like the idea that the departure functions as a kind of foundational event, and that our characters are, in a sense, living in a religious ground zero. Basically, the old religions don't make sense to them anymore. Because this event has a kind of cosmic significance, they're forced to create new religions. And so what we have in this place, Miracle, the Miracle National Park, is a kind of contemporary American Holy Land. And it's some combination of Lourdes and Disneyland and Burning Man. And they have a whole bunch of contemporary metaphors that we think would be the basis for a kind of American Holy Land in the making.
So, Tom, as you said, in The Leftovers, people no longer have faith in the old religions. Why don't they?
You know, this event has happened that basically is unprecedented. 140 million people, give or take, have disappeared instantaneously. It resembles the Christian rapture, but of course also makes a mockery of the Christian rapture because it was random in the way that it worked. And so, you know, Christians don't believe that this makes sense within their cosmology. And we haven't really gotten into a whole bunch of other religions, but there's just a sense in the show that new religions have all the energy and old religions seem bewildered and silent in the face of this you know, literally earth-shattering event.
The character of Matt, the Episcopalian minister, still is trying to hold on to his faith. He lost his church in two ways. First, no one was showing up. And secondly, the church was literally sold to a cult group. So he's a minister without a flock and without an edifice. And he, too, has gone to Miracle. So the question he's facing is whether he can continue to believe in a God, if he can find some sense of meaning in that God in the face of these mysterious losses and suffering. I want to play another scene from The Leftovers, and this is from the first season, the previous season. The character of Kevin, who was the current and then the former police chief of the town of Mapleton, where the story is initially set in New York, he's having trouble enforcing the law and enforcing the rules after these mysterious departures, and he's not sure he can still follow them himself. And in season one, without getting too complicated with the plot, he ends up really angry at the leader of one of these new cult groups, and he'd almost like to murder her, but he's not going to. He's not that kind of man. But she is so angry and so self-hating that she commits suicide in front of him to frame him, knowing that he'll be set up, you know, that people will assume he actually killed her. So he tries to bury the body, and Matt, the minister, helps him do it. And after the ground has covered her over, Matt, the minister, hands the police chief a copy of the Bible and says, "Here, read this." And the police chief says, I'm not a believer. I can't." And Matt says, "No, you asked me to help you. I'm helping. Read this." And he makes Kevin, the police chief, read from the book of Job. Here's Justin Theroux as Kevin reading Graveside from the book of Job.
"If I go to the east, he is not there. If I go to the west, I do not find him. When he is at work in the north, I do not see him. When he turns to the south, I catch no glimpse of him. But he knows the way that I take. When he has tested me, I will come forth as gold. My feet have closely followed his steps. I have kept to his way without turning aside. I have not departed. From the commandment of his lips, I have treasured the words of his mouth more than my daily bread. But he stands alone, and who can oppose him? He does whatever he pleases.
he carries out his decree against me and many such plans he still has in store. That is why I am terrified before him. When I think of all this, I fear him. God has made my heart faint. The Almighty has terrified me. Yet I am not silenced by the darkness, by the thick darkness that covers my face.
I think that's such a beautiful scene, the way he starts reading with such indifference, and by the end he's so choked up because it kind of describes the condition he's in. How did you decide to incorporate Job twice into your series? Like, both clips that we've chosen have the book of Job connected to them.
Job is an amazingly powerful and mysterious part of the Old Testament, and it's the Old Testament God who would just kind of do things because he could. He would never explain himself, but in all cases you must follow, you must believe, and this God could potentially be very vengeful or horrible. And the question that you want coming out of Job is, why did you do this to me? What was the purpose? Why did you destroy my lands and kill my family and cover me in boils? Like, I still believe in you. I just want to know why. And this is the answer. This is an excerpt of the answer that God gives, which is, if I may annotate, because I can. I'm just going to drop the mic and walk away now. That to me feels like an incredibly apt text for The Leftovers.
Well, Terry, can I just add one little thing to what Damon was just talking about? Because I think one of the things that's so beautiful about that graveside reading of the Book of Job is that
we didn't write it.
Yes.
Yeah. First and foremost, let's just acknowledge.
We steal from the best.
Exactly.
But Kevin is reading it very matter-of-factly until he gets to the line that says, I have not departed. And suddenly the text becomes real to him, because departing is the word that the world uses in the wake of this event, this mass disappearance. They call it the sudden departure. And when he says, I have not departed, suddenly this text comes alive for him, and you can hear that happen. And by the time he says, the Lord has terrified me, you hear the fear in his voice, and he's sort of a man. He's standing naked before God in the way that Job does. And it was just amazing, how intimately that passage spoke to our character's situation there.
Damon, what has your engagement with the Bible been? In the past and in the present?
I was raised Jewish. That was the religion of my mother, and we formed an agreement that that I would study Judaism until I was bar mitzvahed, and once a man, I could then opt out if I chose to, and I was kind of counting down the days until that happened. But there were many aspects of Judaism, particularly the cultural aspects of it, that were incredibly appealing to me. I also grew up with this kind of fascination about Jesus. I remember when I was young, like 8 or 9, I went to a Yom Kippur service at my conservative temple, and there were people handing out pamphlets in the parking lot, Jews for Jesus. And all the congregants of my temple were just screaming at these people, get out of our parking lot. And I was like, there was just like these fluttering pamphlets. And I was like, I want to get my hands on one of those. Why are these people so upset about this Jesus person who's kind of been, hidden from me? And as they were kind of leaving the parking lot, they were yelling, Jesus was a Jew. He was a Jew. This was an incredibly sort of curious thing to me. And so I had, I went to my father, who I knew was raised Lutheran, and I said, Dad, what's up with this Jesus character? And he said, sit down, son. You're ready for the truth. And by then, my father was a dyed-in-the-wool atheist, and you can only imagine what he said next. But I'm still processing it as a 42-year-old man.
Just so I don't imagine incorrectly, what did he say?
Oh, he basically said, Jesus is sort of like Santa Claus. And I was like, but there is no Santa Claus. And he said, correct. and kind of went from there. He talked about the Crusades and how 1,500 years ago, a group of very powerful individuals sat down and figured out a way to get immensely wealthy. And today we call that organization the Vatican. My dad was a huge conspiracy. Some would say nut. I would say junkie. It was a fascinating deep dive into what I would call the New Testament. And I've, you know, my dad died when I was in my mid-20s. And once he was gone, I felt like I could actually start having a more positive relationship with the New Testament, because I wouldn't be dishonoring him. And I think there is a lot of beautiful stuff in there.
So Matt, who is the minister, like the one man in the series who still seems to have like faith in a traditional God, you know, in Christ, he tells a story to like the five people remaining in his congregation about a boy who was sick as a child. And this boy didn't know whether to be angry that he was sick or to be grateful that he survived. And I figure Matt, the minister, was probably that boy when he was younger. Now, that's a question that I know I ask myself that a lot, and I know most people do. Not that I was, you know, afflicted with some terrible disease when I was young. But when something bad happens, I think there's always that duality of like, wow, am I angry that this happened to me, or I'm grateful that I got through it? You know, is this an event for like bitterness or an event for gratitude? And I'd love to hear you talk about that and how you wanted to work that into the series.
One of the things that's interesting is that there is the third choice, which is I'm guilty about the fact that I survived. And one of the things we realized last year as we were working our way through season one was that almost all of our characters had some degree of post-traumatic stress. And I think one of the psychological insights of our era is that basically everyone has some form of post-traumatic stress. It is a symptom of being alive in a way. Now, obviously, that's not to say that we all suffer equally. And the other mystery of the show is that some people who have great reason to suffer and to go crazy, like Nora, manage to hold it together. And other people, like Lori Garvey, the wife of Kevin Garvey, less happens to Lori than happens to Nora, but Lori snaps and leaves her family and goes to join a cult. And so we're really interested in these hierarchies and gradations of suffering and also just the mysteries of who can withstand the blows of fate and who crumbles and what resources do they draw upon. That's really right at the heart of the story.
We also think that there's this really interesting, you know, psychological aspect of control when it comes to belief, and particularly for the characters in the show, this idea of wanting to feel like they had some control over the outcome. So if something happens to them, it's as a direct result of something that they themselves have done. In the case of Nora, who Tom mentioned, who loses her children and her husband, they depart. Maybe she wished them away. And that gives her power over her destiny as opposed to something that arbitrarily happened. I've always been fascinated by the idea of natural disasters where, let's say, you built a church and some cyclone comes and smashes your church apart. That's a very confusing idea because you're like, I built this church so that I could worship God, and then God came and destroyed my church. And the congregation tends to default. They don't say, well, there must not be a God then. They default to this idea of we were sinning and God came and destroyed our church, so we're going to rebuild the church and we're going to stop sinning. And that is actually of great comfort because you want to feel like you actually have power and control over this amazing thing that is life. So the story that you referenced, Terry, where Matt is talking about having had leukemia as a child, he rewrites that story to believe that he was afflicted with leukemia because he didn't want a baby sister. when his parents told him that he was going to have a baby sister, he wished that that hadn't happened, and that was a sin, and therefore he got leukemia. And I think that that's a really interesting thing that we do to protect our belief systems, is we end up taking responsibility for these things ourselves.
So we've talked about religion in your series. There's also the supernatural. And there's people who, like, we don't know if the fact that 2% of the world's population simultaneously disappeared in an instant is an act of God or a supernatural event or what. But in season two, there's some supernatural things happening, and it's really hard to tell whether these people actually have supernatural powers or whether it's just other mysterious things going on. And I'm interested for each of you in what your interest is in the supernatural and how far that interest goes. And Damon, let's start with you, since you know you co-created Lost, and that that had a lot of supernatural elements to it.
Sure. I've always been really drawn to supernatural storytelling. I think that the stories that I love the most are real world stories where the supernatural can and often does occur. And I've been really interested by that idea and what we make of it. As these are questions that I've wrestled with my entire life in terms of, you know, what is a bona fide supernatural phenomena? What would it take to convince me? I've always been really interested in psychics, and the show is now kind of taking that idea on in probably a more literal way. But the question that has fascinated me the most, and I'm sure that I'm not alone in this, is what happens when you die? And I think that a lot of religions are basically born out of, well, we'll answer that question for you. We're not only going to tell you what happens when you die, but we'll tell you exactly how to live your life to maximize the rewards that will happen once you do. Having experienced the death of loved ones in my own life and the prism through which I view those experiences, really, really interesting stuff. And so I think that the storytelling that I'm interested in is really talking about death and loss and grief, because that's an ongoing process for me. And when I read Tom's book, I wept. I'm an easy cry, I guess, but I'm not an easy weep. And I just thought it was so profound. This is something that we never did on the series, but one of the things that Nora did in the book was she just watches and catalogs episodes of SpongeBob SquarePants, because that's a show that her kids watched. And I just thought, oh, one of the most interesting things to me about the story is these very unique new coping mechanisms and grieving processes that people will be involved in, because they can't use the old ones, like burying somebody in the ground or cremating them and scattering their ashes. If you don't actually have a physical body, and there's actually this looming possibility that the person who departed might actually come back at some point, or you might be reunited with them, what do you do? Like, what does that look like? And it just tapped into kind of everything that fascinated me as a storyteller.
Just to clarify for people tuning in, Nora's children are among the people who disappeared in this mysterious event in which 2% of the world's population just kind of vanishes in an instant. Tragedy often brings people together, and, you know, communities unite around their collective loss. You know, the president often flies in when something really tragic has happened. But in The Leftovers, it's kind of like the opposite. People are so kind of beset by grief and so unhinged by it and so kind of fearful of what this mystery means that they're attacking each other. People are walking out of their own families because they're so unhinged. Groups are attacking each other. Individuals are attacking each other. The animals seem to have gotten really loopy too. People are shooting what used to be pet dogs. And Tom, can you talk a little bit about imagining how this kind of mass tragedy can set people against each other as opposed to uniting them?
You know, that's really an interesting question in relation to this show, because, you know, when I was writing the book and was thinking about 9/11, I was very clear that I wasn't writing an allegory about 9/11. But you know that one of the things that created, say, the unity in our country after that was this sense that we had an enemy, that there was someone and something to lash out against. And I think the really troubling part of this sudden departure is that nobody knows what to lash out against. They don't know if this was an act of God. They don't know if they should placate God or curse God. They don't know if they were individually responsible. They don't know if they're the lucky ones or the cursed ones. And so I think they're thrown back on their own resources, and they don't have glue that keeps the community together. Now, that said, our main character, Kevin Garvey, played by Justin Theroux, in the first season is really trying to keep the town together. And this cult that his wife has joined is this sort of main opposing force. And so, in a sense, the story of the first season is, can this community and this way of life be kept together? And the answer in season one is no. And now they move to a new place and see if they can try again.
Both Lost, which Damon, you co-created, and The Leftovers on HBO, which you co-created together, based on, Tom, your book, both stories have kind of apocalyptic underpinnings. And I'd like to hear if you were each, during your formative years, worried about some apocalyptic-like event, like nuclear war or terrorism or some kind of like religious apocalyptic story?
You know, the short answer is absolutely. I think, you know, I think most generations are bestowed with this incredible narcissism to feel like we get to be the last ones alive. We get to be the ones who destroy the planet. And so I remember certainly for me, I was born in the early 70s. The idea of nuclear Armageddon as a result of thermonuclear war with the Russians seemed to be the most inevitable outcome. And I think that idea of impending apocalypse has really permeated our culture, and it's something that that people love. The Walking Dead, which is the most popular television show on the air right now, is about apocalypse. The Hunger Games, so the number one television show and the number one movie this past weekend over Thanksgiving were both dystopian apocalypse stories. People are really, really interested in that idea and interested in how they would fare during it.
How do you think you would do if there was like an apocalyptic event? I know I would just like panic and freeze, but what about you guys?
It depends on what the scenario is. And we were actually talking about this over the Thanksgiving weekend, because that's what you do. And I kind of believe if there was a complete and utter collapse of everything that we know and love, and let's just take supernatural phenomena off the table and say that we're not like up against zombies or aliens or something like that, I would protect my family to the best of my ability. But the idea of doing everything that I could to survive in a world like that, I don't think that that I would last long. I think that I would be food pretty quickly.
Tom, one of the things you didn't have to do when you were writing the novel, The Leftovers, that you did have to do when you were creating the TV series, The Leftovers, is come up with theme music. And you both succeeded terrifically with the theme music. The first season had a beautiful instrumental theme that seemed to just kind of underscore the despair of the series, the sense of loss. And this season, there's a song that was already existing by Iris DeMent that kind of literalizes the subject of the series. It's Let the Mystery Be. Like, everybody's wondering why and where we all came from. Everybody's
wondering where they're going to go when the whole thing's done.
Exactly.
But no one knows for certain, and it's all the same to me. Guess I'll
might
just
as well
let
the mystery
be.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yes. Before we hear both versions of the theme, you know, the instrumental theme and then the Iris DeMent theme, can you talk about finding what you thought was the right music to accompany the series? Also understanding that you're going to hear it, if you watch the series, you can hear it week after week, and you'd better not get tired of it.
Let me just start by saying we are incredibly lucky to have Max Richter writing music for the show. Max is responsible for the amazing piano music that really is, I think,
one of the
signatures of the show, and can just really move you every time it appears. There's some kind of emotional signal that it gives off that is really powerful. And anyway, Max wrote the music for the first season opening titles, and I really loved it. But as you say, it was very heavy, and this season we wanted to give off a slightly different emotional vibration at the beginning of the show. And I'll let Damon talk about The Iris Dement, because he was the one who found it and championed it.
Yeah, we love the music that Max wrote for the season one opening, which was almost sort of like a dirge in a lot of ways. It was kind of like it had this Benedictine monk kind of feel to it, and it was overlaid with overtly religious imagery. This beautiful animation that turned out to be revealed to be kind of this fresco painted on the roof of a chapel. So it was overtly religious. And I think that the idea that we always wanted the opening title to remind the audience that a quote unquote religious event had occurred, making the distinction between a supernatural event and religion. Patrick Markey, who is one of our producers in Texas, had asked me when I was down there if I was familiar with Iris Dement and this song in particular. And he sent me this little YouTube clip, and I was just completely and totally bowled over by how apropos it was. And so as we began talking about the opening title sequence for the second season, it just felt like it was the go-to. And once we played it for HBO, it was a done deal. We sampled a number of different pieces of music against that imagery. We also changed the image system up for the second season, but I just can't imagine it not being Iris's music. And what's interesting is the show at its best in its first season was divisive. People had very strong feelings about it one way or the other, but there did seem to be sort of a uniform level of discontent about the opening title sequence in terms of, I do not like it.
Oh God, I love it.
And I'm right there with you. But then what happened was when we changed it, all these people started saying, we loved the first, we hated it. It made us uncomfortable, but we did love it. And I love the, as you say, Terry, the emotional frequency of the new opening. There's something kind of so uplifting and so cheerful, especially when you put it against very dark material. Very often we'll drop our opening title sequence after, a 5-minute opening of a man basically tending to his comatose wife and yelling at her to wake up, and then suddenly you blast into that very upbeat song. I just love the way that it plays against the grain.
Well, it is an upbeat song about knowing everybody's going to die and knowing you don't understand why. That's not so all in all, it's not that upbeat. But okay, so let's hear both of these versions back to back. First, the season one instrumental theme from The Leftovers, and then the season two theme, a song written and performed by Iris Dement. That's the season one, followed by the season two theme for the HBO series The Leftovers. My guests are the co-creators of the series, Tom Perata, who also wrote the novel that it's based on, and Damon Lindelof, who also co-created this series, Lost. Let the Mystery Be, which is the name of the Iris Dement song, that's the theme for the new season. Damon, that seems like a perfect song for you to have as a theme since the end of Lost, kind of let the mystery be. And some of your fans were so angry that things weren't resolved in the way that they wanted it resolved. So if you could briefly tell us what that experience of having fans be that angry with you was like, and how you, what lesson you took away that you did or did not want to apply to The Leftovers.
Yeah, I think that the construct of Lost very specifically was a mystery show. That was the bread and butter of that show. And while we understood that the engine of the show was a mystery engine, the show that we were much more interested in writing was a show about the sort of emotional relationship between these characters and not dotting every I and crossing every T. When I read The Leftovers, which unapologetically, it basically said, we are not going to explain to you, or Tom directly saying, I'm not going to explain where these people went, what happened to the 2% of the vanishees. This book is about people who are living in the aftermath. It is the condition of ambiguity that I am interested in talking about. I suddenly said, wow, this, you know, the nerve of this guy, the guts on this guy, I love it.
So next week, we'll find out how season two of The Leftovers ends. And here's hoping that there's a season three, assuming you want to continue doing it.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks, Terry.
Tom Perata and Damon Lindelof co-created the HBO series Lost. The season two finale is Sunday, but you can start watching from the very first episode on demand.